All right. You guys, can you hear me at all? Can you hear me? Can you hear me now? All right. I was just saying, you guys are troopers. This is a lot to absorb in a very short time. Good news is, though, right after my talk, there's a movie. So, this room, and we'll get going. Let's pray. Lord God, we beg you for your mercy upon us. We need your help. I need your help. Please help me. And bless us now in our time this afternoon. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, generations of students have been trained in schools throughout this nation that science is the key to unlocking the secrets of the universe, and believe the pretensions of those who say that any problem is unimportant if it's not amenable to materialist thinking, which believes that the only thing that exists or that matters is matter, after all. It's not that materialism abolishes religion. It's its own religion. That's what you have to understand. Remember Darth Vader or Darth Tyson Chicken? They're telling you one thing, and if you're naive enough to believe it, then that's the problem. Atheism is its own religion, and it seeks to abolish all competitors. That's the goal of atheism. It seeks to abolish truth. I thought I was going to get pulled off the stage. I haven't blown anything up yet. Speaking of which, I decided to refrain. This is a good example of submission to authority, from bringing up a microwave and showing what you can do with a microwave and matches. I'll have to make a video of that. I remind you again what Pontius Pilate said to Jesus. Remember, what is truth? He asked this question. And the answer is, as I've reminded you before, Christ is the truth. He is the revealed truth of God. People saw him, but particularly through the Bible and in the hearts of his people. Now, I've spoken a lot about the late Carl Sagan, one of the 20th century's great popularizers of atheistic scientism. Note that word, scientism, not science. He calls it science, but it's scientism. He insists that all science must be based on materialist assumptions. Knowledge, remember science, so knowledge, is based on materialist assumptions. And he says that's the only hope for the future. It's the only thing that we can put our hope in. And that is what is taught in the government system of education. It's taught in many Christian schools. It's taught even in some, not so many, but increasingly as people come from different backgrounds, homeschool curricula as well, particularly within the environmental field. If you get any homeschool curriculum even today in the environmental field, they bring that in. I'm sad to say I've looked at them all. And maybe we'll be writing a new curriculum based on more biblical principles. Well, this is what is taught in the government system, and we see that this idea is very powerful within the culture, and it teaches that Christianity is somehow intellectually deficient. It's not intellectually respectable. And so many Christians begin to feel embarrassed, right? That's why many people will accept or be willing to talk about theistic evolution. The idea of, well, okay, God did it. We'll let you say it happened, but God did it. Somehow that makes people think, naive Christians, that this will then get them the respect that they so long for. And so we begin to feel that Christianity has very little to say to our culture. This is what Carl Sagan encourages. He said, as I mentioned yesterday, in the beginning of his book and government-funded TV series Cosmos, the cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. That is the catechism of a high priest of scientism. And it approaches worship of the cosmos. You see, Sagan and all these others, even though they may call themselves atheists, and they may not, they may call themselves Buddhists, Hindus, you know, you have a whole variety in that smorgasbord. he may call himself an atheist, but he's not opposed to worship per se. He's opposed to the worship of Jesus Christ on Christ's terms, because he believes that science looks at the world and it makes brave attempts to fathom objective reality, right? We're just steely-eyed scientists doing hard things. But religion, that's just feelings, wishful thinking and superstition. And actually, you know, he's got a point, because most of religion is just like that, wishful feeling and superstition. In considering God, the God of the Bible, this is what Sagan said, quote, "The idea that God sits in the sky and tallies the fall of every sparrow is ludicrous. But if by God one means the set of physical laws that govern the universe, then clearly there is such a God. This God is emotionally unsatisfying. It does not make much sense to pray to the law of gravity." Darth Sagan, of course, doesn't tell us which law of gravity he's talking about. This is said for a popular audience. If he were talking to other physicists, presumably he'd be a little bit more careful about what he's saying. He's trying to throw sand into the eyes of naive Christians, and actually into the eyes of naive non-Christians as well. In the name of science, Sagan actually suggested a new civic religion of environmentalism, and I think very much in our day we're seeing the rise of that religion. President Obama is the first green president. And that's why, even though I'm a PhD in physics, I wrote this book about the worldview, theology, and ethics of the green movement. Because Sagan was a space physicist like myself. He called, in other statements, you can read the book to hear about that, for the rise of a new religion based on environmentalism. You see, nature then becomes, let's say Mother Nature, puts it more clearly, becomes the god, the goddess, the sustainer, the ruler of everything. You see it in the hotels, don't you? Let's save Mother Nature. And of course, Sagan's not going to be so naive, so feeble-minded as to tell people, like, I really believe in Mother Nature, Mother Earth, as if this is some kind of goddess. Oh, no, no. And we're foolish, though, to think that the Greco-Roman pagans were all earth worshippers. Some of them would have been just like Carl Sagan. Oh, they would talk about the Earth Mother, as she was known in those times. Gaia was one of the names that she was given. But they wouldn't necessarily take it to mean anything more than a metaphor, as does Carl Sagan. Capital N, for Mother Nature, and so on. Not everybody is going to be as honest as Carl Sagan or as outspoken. But what we can learn from Carl Sagan is that there clearly exists in today a religion of science, call it what you want, but there's some kind of new civic religion rising with men like Carl Sagan as the new priests. In the very last book that he published before he died, The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark, he wrote, "Has there ever been a religion with the prophetic accuracy and reliability of science? No other human institution comes close." Now, he's equivocating, there's a fallacy here, because we do know that science, like I said yesterday, has been wonderful to us in giving us these lights and computers and air conditioning and so on. But the philosophy that he is trying to slide in together with those things is not the same whatsoever. That's very big talk. Very big talk from the Sagan. And if he's being sincere, then it reflects a confusion on his part about the nature of religion and the nature of science, true science. Because, you know, we agree, no other institution even comes close. But what about divine institutions? You see, the church is not a human institution. It is a divine institution. For Sagan to kind of say these things that he says is really trying to put himself on a par with God. He's some kind of superman. And can these claims, which reflect an incredible pride, and I'm sorry to say, lots of people go into physics and things like that, because there is a pride which they want to foster, right? Give me hard things to do. Challenge me, you know. Don't give me the easy stuff. Give me the hard things. Sagan is reflecting this incredible pride. I don't think that this pride and these kind of statements can be sustained under any serious criticism. And ironically, Sagan himself never became perceptive enough to critique carefully his own religion, which is a worldview which has wrapped reality into some kind of straitjacket. It's like a vampire octopus that just wants to grab everything and suck the life out of it. How can Sagan even talk about truth with his worldview? It has no objective meaning. Now, the United States has produced an enormous number of brilliant physicists in the past 100 years or so, one of which is Robert Millikan. Robert Millikan wrote with complete sincerity that in science, truth once discovered always remains truth. So if you find something out, like there are protons or whatever it may be, then that's the way it's always going to be. That's the truth. It sounds familiar because Darth Tyson Chicken actually said something similar yesterday. But, as I mentioned, these kind of silly statements, they just dissolved. They were crushed by the blows of Einstein and quantum physics, Einstein and Heisenberg. Karl Popper, a philosopher of science and physicist, very highly respected, pointed to even deeper problems when he wrote, quote, "First, although in science we do our best to find the truth, we are conscious of the fact that we can never be sure whether we have got it. We know that our scientific theories always remain hypotheses. In science, we never have sufficient reason for the belief that we have attained the truth." What? I know that for some of you this can be earth-shattering. Do you hear what he's saying? This is totally opposite to the grand vision of Millikan or Tyson or Dawkins or Sagan, who are saying that science is all about truth and we'll tell you the way it is. Just come and fall down before us and we'll tell you the way it is. They dream of science as a candle in the dark, right? Everything's dark. Nobody can see, right? Switch these lights up, nobody can see. But science is that candle in the dark. And Karl Popper says, we don't even know what we're talking about. He says that science is utterly incapable of truth. Well, what does he mean? I remind you, science is the pursuit of knowledge and understanding. But in scientism, what they're trying to do is to resolve all the capacities of human beings into the senses and modifications of the senses. And that view abolishes God entirely. Another way that you could call it, another name that you could call it, is philosophical naturalism. And many people think that this is the scientific way. And because it's propounded, who was it who stuck that toast peg on me, by the way? I found it. I will get you. You're not afraid? You will be. Remember, you repeat a lie over and over enough, and people begin to believe it. It becomes hard to fight against the currents that go. But Popper says, Sagan is naive. Sagan is clueless. To be clear, theology is the queen of sciences, and theology is what studies God. Theology is the study of God, and the source of absolute truth in theology, and everything really, is the Word of God, the Scriptures. This is the Bible. It is God speaking to us. It is God who creates, and God who sustains all things. All other sciences are secondary to theology, and they have to derive from it. This is the way God has designed the world. But this is the view that's rejected by atheistic scientism. Now, we've got this illusion of objectivity, right, in the sciences. especially physics, which is very, very hard. And I don't mean that it's difficult. I mean it's very precise. We can talk about the mass of things to minuscule measurements, distances, right, to units that we can't even say. All of the rivals to science, many of these people are saying, have been relegated to the realm of the subjective. But, okay, today what we're going to do is we're going to start by saying, well, what if we assume that there is no God? This is very dangerous. It's actually sinful. So we won't. But let's try to get into the mind of some of these people who assume that there is no God. If that is the case, is knowledge even possible? Now, because I don't want you to misunderstand, let me reiterate what I said yesterday. The Bible teaches us that knowledge is possible, but that we must be careful because we are finite creatures. We are fallen creatures. Even if we are Christians and we are having ourselves renewed, our minds, after the image of Jesus Christ, we still have to be careful because our knowledge is never absolute. Our knowledge is never complete. We must always submit every piece of our knowledge to God, and therefore to the Word of God. So I'm not saying that knowledge is impossible. I'm saying that on these people's assumptions, knowledge is impossible. And this gives you some tools to really cut the legs out. This is the atomic, the nuclear approach to cutting the legs out. We could talk about evidences from geology and whatever showing that the world couldn't be 15 billion years old. But ultimately, the nuclear approach is one that I favor. I like that much better. Let's just nuke them. So if we begin by assuming there is no God, is knowledge even possible? Let me try to explain. We're told, just free your mind. We're going to come teach you if you go to college or if you go to some courses. Just look at the observations and see where it leads. You already know that this is not possible because you have to have some faith commitment in order to even begin to move. My Berkeley professor said this. Remember, my external examiner, scientists don't believe. They're just convinced by the evidence. Actually, they begin by assuming there is no God. That's an assumption. And let's see today where this leads. Do you see me? Who said no? You don't see me? What do I need to do to help you see me? How do you see me? You're seeing me with your eyes. Now, I don't want to do biology, that's interesting, but I want to do the physics of the situation. So if this room was dark, if we switched off all these... I better not say anything to prejudice you. If this room were dark, could you see me? Yeah. Okay, you couldn't see me. Right, I'm not assuming you're going to put your infrared goggles on or anything like that. That's cheating. We switched the lights off. Would I no longer be here because you could not see me? Obviously not. So what does that conversation suggest to you about the relationship between light and sight? They somehow are related. There's some relationship. You're doing science, right? Lights go off, you don't see. Lights go on. This is observation. You're making deductions. Well, what is light? Don't be stressed out, please. Just hold on to your seats. Physicists don't know what light is. We don't know. I can teach a course. I can keep people busy for 2 semesters at least on light. But I don't actually know what light is, which is amazing if you think about that. Where does light come from, folks? Where does light come from? In a closed room, where is the light coming from here? Looking at that one up there. Some kind of light bulb, right? And the bulb, I need that flashlight. In fact, I also need maybe 3 more student volunteers to come and join me on the stage here.
Yes, you.
Oh, how many do we have? Just going to stand right there. Yeah, come on over. Right. Have everybody. Okay, stand in the middle there. I think we'll have you stand right in the middle. Open that for me, will you? So you said the light comes from the light bulb. Can I have that torch, the flashlight?
Just press the button. If it doesn't work, just press it again.
Okay, thank you. Whoa. Fancy. Okay, if you flick the switch, the room will immediately go dark, right? We won't be able to see what's going on. Now, if you switch the lights back on, you suddenly see, don't you? What does this suggest to you about light? Because you told me that the light's coming from the light bulb, but there's some light over here right now. So if it's coming from there, okay, it moves. There's some kind of motion involved with this whole concept of light. And we can experiment, right? I can put my hand here, and you can see the light there on my hand, and there's no light on the screen, yes? Even those who can't see. Now, if I move my hand away, what do you see? Somehow there's some correlation between what's happening here and over there. There is no light there, and now there is. The light seems to be coming from here, and now it's over there. So this sort of seems to fit with your theory that light moves really quickly, that there's motion involved. Okay? So you actually can see movement of the light. We could have some kind of experiment and put little sections all along this distance and measure that. In fact, we do measure that with fancy physics experiments. It moves so fast. We talked about that 186,000 miles per second yesterday. Well, let me try to explain how physicists say that they see. We don't know what light is. I'll be upfront and honest with you. And pass the balls to the other gentlemen. Emphasis on gentle, please. We don't want anybody to get hurt more than they deserve. The idea that physicists have is that light interacts with matter, and that interaction changes the light somehow. And then when the light comes into your eyes, the interaction that happens somewhere else, that change is reflected in what your mind perceives. Right? But what exactly is light? We haven't quite defined what that is. So physicists would say, well, in the early days, they vacillated between opinions. Light is a particle. You know that other people say, well, light is a wave. And today, whimsically, one might say that light is a wavicle. We don't know what light is. But if we were wanting to assume a particle nature for light, right, how would you experiment? How would you test the nature of light? So imagine if you were blind. And you're going to have to imagine that you're blind. I want you three guys to, let's just move up here. You can stand right here. Abigail, right, just move over, Matthew. Abigail stands right there. Matthew, you can stand there. Well, let's stand over here so that everybody can see what we're going to do to Abigail. Danny over here. And Philip over here. Okay, take a look where everybody is, Abigail. We'll pretend that you can just take a look and see where everybody is. Okay? So, how would you know what's going on in your world? Let's assume that these are all givers of light. They are all producing light. How would you figure it out? I can see that somebody's already thinking. What's your idea? He just had a ball in his hand, and you know that just created all kinds of ideas about. Well, if light is a particle and a ball, you can kind of think as a particle. If you were blind, you could throw a ball out forwards, right? And if it hit something, and then it bounced back and hit you, you could learn something about what it was that it hit, right? So, for instance, if you were to throw a ball, just be cool. If you were to throw a ball, then Abigail could feel something about, she'd know something about you, right? She'd know something about the strength of your arm. She'd know something about where you are. This is the particle nature of light. Okay? You can learn something about the nature of things from which the light particles are coming from. Okay? And if you throw lots and lots of balls, if a whole bunch of balls were coming off every part of your body and you could measure the impact of these balls, you could presumably make some kind of picture of what's going on over here. Does that kind of make sense to you? We do the same kind of thing with sound, with echoes and so on. So we're going to have you close your eyes to reduce your senses, to remove information, to remove data. I wanted ping pong balls, and they were at Walmart, but I thought that these would be more effective. Now, you must realize that as the ball gets thrown, when it strikes you, when it strikes you, the light giver might move. Isn't that possible, Abigail?
It is.
So he could throw the ball and then move. So you, go ahead, just gently. No. Let's get closer. Let's just get closer. Okay, close your eyes.
I might miss again.
Just go for it. Very good. Okay, so she's blind. This is the only data she has. Where did the ball come from? Pretty awesome. She learned something about truth, reality, okay? Particle nature of light. Okay, so behind you we have Philip, and Philip is about to throw the ball. So Philip, throw the ball. Philip just threw the ball a moment ago. Sorry, somebody threw it back to me. Okay, now you can open your eyes. Tell us what happened.
You hit first, then you hit. Anyway, you hit me. You tried to hit me.
I didn't. Those three had balls, remember? Sorry, and he threw the ball, and I don't know what. Did you throw your ball? No, after, when it was
close to.
No, he didn't. So, we're asking what happened. So, the difficulty is clearly that once somebody throws the ball, it takes a certain amount of time for the ball to travel, doesn't it? And in the time that it takes to travel, somebody could move to a different place. Or the balls might curve. You know, you've seen tennis. Right? You threw the ball so hard that it did something weird and it came back. Okay, you can leave the stage. You've been very good. Oh. So it takes light, in this particle theory of light, a certain amount of time to travel, right? So when you're saying you don't see me, actually, based on that particle assumption of light, you're right. Because if the light comes and bounces off me and then it goes into your eyes, it takes a certain amount of time for the light to travel from me to your eyes. And in that time, I may have moved to over here. And you're looking over there and you say, Dr. Wanless is standing over there, but actually I've moved. And then you see me over here, and I move again. I can do that. You know, if I move faster than the speed of light, you want to see me do it? You don't believe it? Okay, you ready? Did you see it? too quick for you. So first of all, Abigail had a reasonable reflection of the truth from her model that she had constructed, this particle nature of light. Not so. But how do you know that that model is always a reasonable reflection of truth? This is part of the problem that we have. The answer is, under atheistic assumptions, we don't know. We have no reason to expect the world to reflect some order or constancy or design. And therefore, if you assume that there is no God, and if you rely strictly on your own senses, when strange things happen, you won't know how to explain them. On strictly philosophical grounds, you don't know if I'm even there, if you're an atheist, if I'm real. Man's total depravity has rendered all knowledge relatively true at very, very best. And I think Dr. Piper kind of mentioned this yesterday. Even in theology, we have to be super careful because it's very easy for us to mess up. Apart from God's aid, we will fail in our science. And Jesus explained the problem even further. Lots of people think, well, if we just give enough information to people, then everybody will believe. Well, Jesus said that's not the case. That's not the problem. If you just give them enough data, right? Scientists are convinced by the data. It's not that they believe anything. No, that's nonsense, says Jesus. He said, if I tell you, you will not believe. That's Luke 22. Even if I tell you, you're not going to believe. And he's telling the truth. And then Luke 16. He said, if they hear not Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded though one rose from the dead. They could see someone rising from the dead, and they would make some kind of theory that explained. In fact, they do. You can find those books on the market. It was just they'd make some kind of excuse, some theory. Like Abigail was trying to rationalize what was going on, right? Humans are incredibly creative in making theories. You feel free to tell Abigail what actually was going on later on. On atheistic assumptions, sensual information, observation, no matter how much you do, is not enough. Cannot reveal absolute truth. So there are several considerations that I want us to look at. On these atheistic assumptions, there are problems like the problem of induction, of experimentation, of observation, and of selection, data selection. We know that we do physics in the laboratory, and we make observations, and we do experiments with equipment and so on that allows our senses to be expanded far beyond the natural range. And one example would be the mass of a proton. The mass of a proton. Mass of a proton is supposed to be 1.67 times 10 to the minus 27. 1.67 times 10 to the minus 27. Kilograms. So it's incredibly small. Nobody's ever seen a proton, but we can measure indirect effects and from those make assumptions about what it is that we're seeing. Okay? We're blind to that quantum world, but we see something happening, and based on our theories we can measure the mass. And we can do it many, many times under controlled circumstances, and we find that mass plus or minus some small amount. So let's say we measure a billion protons. Is that enough times for us to know what is the mass of a proton? Right? Can a physicist say, here's a proton, I know its mass is 1.67 times 10 to the minus 27 kilograms? I think a Christian probably has reasonable expectations to say that we can know that. But on atheistic assumptions, can he know? How does the physicist know that nature has not changed from now to the next time he measures it? How does he know that it won't change again in the future? How does he know? He doesn't know. He doesn't know. And he has no reason to demand that nature remains ordered as he has seen it in the past. The atheist assumes that there's no reason for anything. There's no meaning to the world. There's no God. There's no love. There's no hate. Everything is just matter and atoms in random motion. And in a world of total randomness, the scientist doesn't have the ability to talk about the mass of a proton or of anything really. Let me think of another example. You see a bluebird fly by, let's say. You see a million bluebirds fly by, and every year you see the bluebirds come fly by. Every bluebird that you see is blue. Right? Are you therefore able to say that when you see a white bluebird, that it's not a, well, white bird is definitely not a bluebird? How do you know that they aren't bluebirds that have no pigment, right? We have that for human beings. However much the sagas of science may wish it, physics cannot honestly claim that kind of omniscience. We don't know. We don't know based on atheistic assumptions. We have no reason to expect this. And speaking of protons, you know, as I said just before, we could say 1 second later. How do we know that the mass of the proton is the same 1 femtosecond later? I already told you strange things happen to the mass of the proton when it moves. It increases. So we have problems. How does he know? He doesn't know. How does he know that the mass of the proton is not the same, is the same in Tennessee as it is in South Carolina? He doesn't know. Well, if he goes and does the experiment, he says, I went and did the experiment. That's how I know. Well, you did it at this time and you did it at that time. They're two different times. You're not comparing apples with apples. How do you know? He cannot know. And then there's another problem, this problem of experimentation. In an experiment, a physicist tries a hypothesis. So if Abigail had the ability to shoot the balls out and wait to see what happens afterwards, that's your experiment, and then you form a hypothesis as to what you feel, what happens, what you observe later. So for instance, let's hypothesize that there is permeating all the space in this room a force field, which we will call gravity. Let's see, I have this ball here in my hand. What will happen if I let go of this ball? How many of you say four? Just raise your hands. Okay, the vast majority. How many? Anybody care to say anything different? I heard somebody shout out something. Yes. The earth will be attracted to the ball. Okay. Somebody else said something over here?
Nothing.
Nothing will happen to the ball. So if I let it go, it will just be hanging in the air. Right? Let's see. It fell. Yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's in this room. So I let the ball go in the presence of this force field, which we call gravity. I hypothesized the existence of this field called gravity. Yes? I said, I let the ball go, the ball falls. Right? I say, if there is gravity, the ball will fall, the ball falls. And you say it will fall because of gravity. You've made that hypothesis. You drop the ball does fall. What do you conclude? So you said, if there's a force field, which we call gravity in this field, the ball will fall. I let the ball go. The ball does fall. What do you conclude? That there is a force field of gravity, right? In a world of no reason, no purpose, no design, then what justification is there for you to believe that the ball will fall down? Why should there be such a thing then as gravity in a random world? No reason whatsoever. This is where I was going to bring the microwave in and the explosions, but the scientist doesn't know. In a random world, why won't the ball fall up? Why won't it fall sideways? There's an infinite number of possible things that could happen. And yet, this is precisely the kind of reasoning that a scientist relies on. We assume too much if we assume an atheist world. Then there's another problem. This is the problem of observation. This problem of observation is enormous. What we actually do in a lab is I wouldn't drop the ball just one time. I would drop the ball a million times, right? Is one time enough to see what's going to happen with the ball? Really? Like once? You do it once and then that's cool? No, I'd have to drop it a million times. But when do I stop? How many times is going to be enough times to drop the ball and know for sure, yeah, that's what's happening? Gravity's... There is no end on atheist assumptions. That's right. There is, it's never enough. Never enough. The exact number of observations cannot be stated. What you really do in the physics lab is you drop the ball, you shoot something, whatever, a million times. Basically, you stop when you get tired. And then you average everything together and you say, okay, this is what I found. But we have no reason. Even the statistical assumptions we make, which I won't get into because it gets kind of mathematically ugly quickly, but if anybody's savvy enough to talk about that, feel free to talk with me afterwards. Even those assumptions have problems which we can't rely on. So not only that, this problem of experimentation, how many times is enough to know something on atheistic assumptions? We can be fooled by our senses. I showed you yesterday. Let's see. I don't think we have sound.
Things that can't be done. Like less fuel in for more miles out. And impossible made possible.
Thank you, Honda. It fooled your senses, didn't it? And yet it was all real. This wasn't touched up. It was data. And as you got more data, as you got more observations, you said, okay, I can see what's going on. Right? And you sensed that your senses were being fooled. Why? Because you are operating in God's world. You are operating with things that you can see on justified true belief, justified by the Bible, that the world is governed by a rational design and designer. And you see what is the illusion. But here's the thing. If you take atheist assumptions, how do you know that what you thought was the illusion is not the reality? In other words, that you're not seeing an illusion of an illusion. How do you know that when you think you see that real picture now, I'm confused, okay, now I see what happens. How do you know that that picture is not the illusion? Right? Some will say, well, we just need enough data. If we get enough data, then we can resolve everything. That's what Sagan and the others say. Well, how much data is enough? That gives us that problem again. Under atheist assumptions, there's no answer. No answer. It's never enough. And so to avoid going crazy, going mad as an atheist, you have to assume a Christian view of the world, that it's designed by a rational being. They assume this when they do their science, even while with their mouth they say that they deny it. The fool says in his heart there is no God. Then there's the problem of selection, right? We select a few variables if we want to do an experiment at a time. Here we have the curve of weight versus height for human beings, which you saw. And here are your data superimposed. You're normal. None of you are off the curve. Oh, wait a second. There you are. That's the alien among us, top right. What's the curve? What is the law? What is the model that fits these data? I could make a model and say, all right, a straight line fits these data. Is that a good model? What might be a better model of those data? Obviously the one that goes through the most points, right? It describes, so maybe a curve like that. Okay, and would you stop there? Would you stop? Here are three curves drawn nicely so you can see. Would you stop and say, okay, we've got a great model. This is the best model. We'll use that one. Really? I can get an infinite number of models. I can get a model here that goes through every single data point, so the error between my model and the data points, so I can just keep going, is zero. It's the perfect model. We can have an infinite number of curves going through you. You can think of a number of shapes. There's an infinite number. You can eliminate some models, certainly. Right? This curve obviously doesn't work. We can eliminate that, but there's still an infinite number of models, an infinite number of physical laws that we could draw fitting through there. How do we know which one's right? Well, according to Karl Popper, philosopher of science, Even the best theories have the same probability, namely zero. In other words, none of them are right, operating on atheistic assumptions. So, what hope is left for somebody who is an atheistic materialist in practice, if not in principle? If one wants to do science with an atheistic worldview, there's no rhyme nor reason to anything. Bertrand Russell had this to say. He got to the heart of it. This is meaty. That man is the product of causes that had no prevision of the end they were achieving. That his origin, his hopes, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms. That no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve individual life beyond the grave. That all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system. And that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. He's saying, in really fancy English, it's all hopeless. All your greatest aspirations are hopeless. As Mr. Botkin was saying, you know, you don't have any meaning in your work. You think you're working for some higher meaning on atheist assumptions. There is no meaning. It's all ruins. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. Brief and powerless is man's life. On him and all his race, the slow, sure doom falls pitiless and dark. What's left now, Sagan's overweening pride? Right, this is kind of an attempt at that, right, we steely-eyed, there is no hope, but let's just do the best we can. Drop your Christian faith, they say. Have faith in this instead. What? With this faith, even pride becomes meaningless. Even poor unbelievers cannot do science. It's impossible for them. Every scientist, however, can do science. Even unbelieving scientists can. And why? Because they have built into them, in their hearts, the knowledge of truth. Romans chapter 1 teaches us, telling us that people willfully blind themselves. But except for those who have gone crazy, when they are consistent to these principles, they have to live with this dissonance in their life. All men know that there's a God, and we actually see it by the way they live. For instance, let's just think about the Hindus, just as this is a really clear example. Hindus believe that everything is Maya. Have you heard this? All is Maya. Maya means illusion. Everything is an illusion. Nothing is objectively real. Everything that you see is Maya. You're creating the reality in your mind, if you like. Nothing is real. And yet it's really interesting if you were to visit India, when you see that bus hurtling down the road and the Hindus scattering, jumping out of the way of the bus, why don't they just say, there is no bus? Because there really is a bus. That's why. They have to live in God's world. And there are many levels in God's world which we cannot escape this reality. It's His world. It's His time. It's His space. And we are His subjects. And so we ignore certain facts of life at our peril. Atheists are just like the Hindus. They hide these facts from themselves about the genuine nature of reality. They assume and they use the attainability of knowledge, of truth, and yet they can't explain how this is even possible in a universe made up of finite beings, in a universe that is entirely random. Now, Christians, if you listened yesterday, would not be concerned by this. You can laugh, but if there are those among you who have had this faith in science, I'll be okay if you curl up into a ball. You should be freaking out. Now, go ahead. But to the Christians, I say, remember how I said in the first two lectures, The Christian worldview makes sense of the truth, of the world that we see, of reality and experience. We understand that science depends on God and rests on the truth of His Word. We realize that we're finite, that God has made an order. He's not tricking us. He's told us to take dominion, to have a calling, as we heard, to go forth, to be fruitful and multiply, to make this world fruitful as well. But non-Christians can do this too. They are created in God's image, just as we are, with an inborn love for truth, a relish for truth, just like the baby that I told you about yesterday. We aspire to investigate the world, to learn how it works. It's a wonderful thing, and that's how, when you do your science, you can reach out, you're stretching forward to grasp at things that reveal the glory of our Creator. The only way that the person, Christian or not, can make sense of the world in which he lives is by assuming Christian presuppositions, which they do. The Hindus jump out of the way of the bus because God has made them His image also. But as they become more consistent with their own professed philosophy, they taste disillusionment and even their best achievements, because they're rejecting Jesus Christ, and yet truth is ultimately bound up in Jesus Christ, whom the Bible calls the truth. He is the foundation and author of the truth. In conclusion, I hope that you see that the powerlessness of science without the Christian foundation as a route to truth is important for us to shout from the rooftops to try to understand. The scientific enemies of Christ have no foundation for their attacks on truth. Christianity has a monopoly on absolute truth, for the grounds of absolute truth is found in Scripture alone. And so we now have no more an excuse to misrepresent the limits of science. Great as it is and has been to us, we mustn't misrepresent the limits. Christians begin with what? We begin with the infinite, eternal, unchangeable God, and atheists begin with matter. And yet, Dawkins and Sagan and those like them do not live true to their philosophy. On their assumption, science is not possible. Actually, even language is not possible. It's just a bunch of compressions and rarefactions, right? It's just oscillations in the air. At the end, after listening to all of this, after thinking about how many atheistic scientists and those who may have some kind of nature-based religion, which is effectively practical atheism, one can wonder, as they despair of truth, why they don't see the Christian view of the world as that actual candle in the darkness. Psalm 14 explains why. Other Psalms do too. Romans 1 does as well, because fools blind themselves. It's a terrible thing when you go out into the world and you see what people will do to themselves, how they will maim themselves and harm themselves in madness. Fools blind themselves. And this isn't very much unlike the situation which is recounted near the end of the very last book of the Chronicles of Narnia. You know, you have a gaggle of dwarfs there, huddled in the bright open air on clean ground, and yet they are so deluded, blinded in their minds. They see with their eyes, but their minds are misinterpreting what they are seeing. They think that they are in a dank, dark stable. Their creator had prepared for them a magnificent feast, and he stood in person, just a breath away from them, really close. And yet reason and evidence would not sway their fatal vanity. If your mind is messed up, you see, like Jesus said, wrong things. You won't even believe if you see a man rise from the dead. They ate the feast, these dwarfs, ungratefully. They guzzled it. They had these delicacies and they were spitting them out. You remember the scene, any of you? They're spitting it up. What is this feeding us mud? And they munched in misery, in a pathetic perversion of precious half-remembered traditions. And the reason is because they rejected their Maker. That's the message there. And in rejecting their Maker, they didn't achieve the liberation they so desired, the freedom. They had instead created for themselves only a prison of darkness and misery. They became blind to goodness, and they became blind to truth. And Lucy, the little queen in the story, remember, she expressed astonishment. She was just, what's wrong with these people? She said, but it isn't dark. You poor, stupid dwarfs, said she, can't you see? Look up. Look round. Can't you see the trees and the sky and the flowers? Can't you see me? The dwarfs wouldn't hear it. You're lying. You're lying. There's no God. There's no personal God. Right? They said there's no Aslan. They insulted the very idea in an ugly reply, suggesting that God is a fraud. They said, quote, how in the name of all humbug, that's a minced oath, can I see what ain't there? And how can I see you any more than you can see me in this pitch blackness? The atheist scientists want you to say, it's all hopeless. Just trust us, and somehow you can find the strength for this life in this cursed world. What fools! In the end, science cannot serve as a religion, because as Eve learned in Eden, men and women cannot become God. Thank you.